Political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Ashe.
Ashe.
We'll pour it to the creative spirit. The great Ashe out of which we all emerge, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to that created spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science, Ashe.
Okay.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren, their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who, finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places, learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God, oh Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand, and who sit here, buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, "Stop! No more! We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths." We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names. Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Lee Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X,
John Henry Clark, John Jackson, Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children, children's children, who will one day stand on this space and speak your name.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
The following is a public service announcement from the Black Reality Think Tank.
My name is Leola Williams. I am the owner of an outpatient mental health and substance abuse facility. I am a clinical substance abuse and mental health counselor. I appreciate the Black Reality Think Tank for inviting me on their program to share with you some of the things to help reduce your fear and stress during this pandemic. I know we are all experiencing fear and uncertainty at this time, not knowing who or what to trust, coming from the media or the White House, which makes it difficult to remain calm. One thing that I would strongly suggest is to reduce the amount of time you spend watching the news. Try to increase your communication with family and friends. Listen to your favorite music. Perhaps start an in-home garden with your children. Have them to plant their favorite vegetable garden. Play a word game with family and friends using the first letter of their name to create a word to describe themselves. Exercise together, make it challenging. Dance, show off your old routines. Share some of the rules from the old days that your grandparents implemented. Watch a movie together. Have a nice, fun day together. Learn to breathe, relax, and take one day at a time and pray daily. These are just a few tips on how to reduce your stress.
Don't be deluded that the world is full of benevolent individuals and institutions whose only claim to fame is that they want to lift Africa from the morass that she now finds herself in. The reality is, the poverty of Africa is the glory of some civilizations. Poverty is an industry. Ignorance is an industry. Big industry. And there are those who want Africa to continue to wallow in poverty and to wallow in ignorance because it is their safest bet to their continued benefit. The day we wake up to that reality, the safer we are. That is why the English had this beautiful saying, "Let sleeping dogs lie." So we are sleeping and we are being allowed to lie. And we are being hypnotized into even greater sleep and slumber to dream even further. But I'm telling us, if Africa is to realize our dream, we must wake up. If Africa is to win the lottery, we must buy the lottery ticket. Why are we ring-fencing 30%? Let us ring-fence 70%. It can be done because it is a question of cross fertilization of ideas. We must learn from other civilizations, but learning must not mean surrendering to them. I'm submitting to us that we surrender.
Good afternoon, Hotep, and greetings, my brothers and sisters. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. My name is Dr. William Rogers. We are here every Tuesday evening from 7 p.m. Central to 9 p.m. Central here on the TimeForAnAwakening.com radio network, which is also a part of the Black Talk Radio Network. We thank you so much, as always, for your patronage and participation and for your listening presence. We are in some very difficult times, and so it is so great that we are able to sit down together as brothers and sisters and talk and use this platform and this medium to do that. We have a wonderful and dynamic discussion tonight with three wonderful young brothers who I've known for a long time. They're going to come on and talk about some of this crisis, some of this spirit of death that we are walking in every single solitary day. And so we as people who care for each other and who love each other must continue to talk and make sure that we all understand and that we can, as the song said in the beginning, lean on me if you have to. And so again, we thank you for coming. We are also broadcasting on a weekend edition. Every Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock Central Time, we have a weekend edition that we just started, and we will continue a lot of our dialogue that we do here on Tuesday night, on Friday night. And that program is hosted by two wonderful young ladies from our community who do a magnificent job. Their maiden voyage was last Saturday, and it was a wonderful opportunity, wonderful conversation, and we had a lot of folks that joined it and did talk a lot about the subject matter at hand. So again, I thank you for being here. Black Talk Radio Network is also a part of, as I said, the Time for an Awakening. Our program, the Black Reality Think Tank, is produced by the Sankofa Historical Society, and it is, our sponsorship is organization called African Perspectives, Motherland Media, which is run and operated by Brother Oshieme Adelabu, who also has a program on this network as well, on every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 Eastern to 1 Eastern, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So you get an opportunity. We'll talk more about that and some of the other programs that are on this system as well. But tonight we're going to talk about the death march of black life as we watch. And some of us are not only just watching, we are out participating, trying to get our people to see. Tired of the Facebook post of death of this person we've lost and that person we've lost and this person we've lost. And some of the horrible figures and numbers. And so we're gonna kind of get to the heart of that. And we've got three wonderful brothers who have some understanding of what's behind a lot of this. And we're just going to open up and see what we can find and enlighten our community so that everybody will be prepared. As always, you know, we do a ancestral profile, which is a part of our program format. The ancestral profile is a way of honoring our ancestors. The great Fannie Lou Hamer from rural Mississippi had a very famous saying. She said, "We must always praise the bridges that brought us over." And so I do believe that. We stand on the shoulders of greatness, very powerful men and women who suffered just like we're suffering now, if not even worse. We stand on their shoulders, and they survived. And as Brother Carr said in his libations, we are the ones that couldn't be killed. We are the ones, the descendants of those who did not die, that made it through the Middle Passage, that made it through the plantations of Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, North Carolina, Virginia. We are their descendants, and we have a duty to carry on so that that generation that's following us will also have a chance to survive. And so that's why we're here tonight. We're here tonight to bring forward those ideas. Our ancestral profile is a sister that I've always loved and dearly enjoyed. Her African name is Gamba Adisa. Gamba Adisa. Her American name was Audrey Lord. Audrey Lord. Audrey Geraldine Lord was born on February the 18th, 1934, in New York City. and went on to become a leading, and I'm saying, and I do mean a leading, African-American poet and essayist who gave voice to issues of race, gender, and sexuality. Lloyd's love of poetry has started at a very young age. She began writing as a teenager. She attended Hunter College in New York, working to support herself through school. And after graduating in 1959, she went on to get a master's degree in library science from Columbia University in 1961. For most of the 1960s, Audre Lorde worked as a librarian in Mount Vernon, New York, and in New York City. She married an attorney by the name of Edwin Rollins in 1962, and the couple had two wonderful children, Elizabeth and Jonathan. She and Brother Rollins were later divorced. Ms. Lloyd's life changed dramatically, though, in 1968. Her first volume of poetry, called First Cities, was published. And that same year, she left her job as a head librarian at Town School Library in New York City. Also in 1968, Ms. Lloyd taught a poetry workshop at Tougaloo College in Mississippi, witnessing firsthand the deep racial tensions in the South. There she would publish her second volume of poetry entitled Cables to Rage. And she did that in 1970. And in that work, she took on themes of love and things like deceit and family, which also addressed her own sexuality in the poem. She took on the character of Martha. She would later teach at John Jay College and Hunter College in New York. Audre Lorde's third volume of poetry was From a Land Where Other People Live. She published that in 1973. It earned a lot of praise and was nominated for a National Book Award. In this volume, she explored issues of identity as well as concerns about global issues. Her next work was called The New York Head Shop and Museum. And this was published in 1975. It was more her political voice that was overtly political than most of her early poems. With the publication of Cole by a major book company in 1976, Sister Lloyd began to teach a larger audience. She did another book called The Black Unicorn in 1978. And in this volume, Ms. Lloyd explored her African heritage. It is considered one of the greatest works by any critics. Throughout her poetry and other writings, she tackled topics that were important to her as a woman of color, as a lesbian, as a mother, and as a feminist. She went into a very deep battle with cancer. In addition to poetry, Audre Lorde was a powerful essayist and writer. And in terms of her nonfiction work, she is best remembered for something called the Cancer Journals. And she wrote that in 1980, in which she documents her own struggle with breast cancer. Having undergone a mastectomy, Lloyd refused to be victimized by the disease. Instead, she considered herself and other women like her. Excuse me, please. If someone has their mic open, could you please close that? I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And so as Audre Lorde battled the cancer and she began to write about it, she wrote something called A Burst of Light in 1989. And this time she chose to pursue alternative treatments rather than to opt for more surgery. She battled cancer for more than a decade and spent her last few days living in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Around this time, she took an African name called Gamba Adisa, and that meant she who makes her meaning clear. Audre Lorde died on November the 17th, 1992, on the island of St. Croix, largest of the U.S. Virgin Islands. And over her long, long career, Lorde received numerous accolades, including an American Book Award for A Burst of Light, which she wrote in 1989. She is remembered today for many of being a great warrior and a poet who valiantly fought many personal and political battles with her world. And that is the life of Gamba Adisa. Gamba Adisa. Okay, my brothers and sisters, we want to get ready to get right into this conversation. And again, I asked our brothers and sisters that I know most of the mics are mute. I know who our guests are here already. I see them online. And so I'm going to mute the other mics just for a second until we get into the conversation, give them a chance to present what they want to do, and then we're going to come back and open up the lines and give you a chance, the audience, as always, to speak and to ask questions and so forth. Well, brothers and sisters, as you know, as our title indicated tonight, that this is the dead march, the death march of black life. That is one of the things that we are seeing. Also, we actually posted two titles for this program tonight. And the other thing that we are looking at, we want to have hope. So I wanted to talk about back to life and back to reality. And I borrowed that from the Sister Latoya Luckett song, but it's very appropriate for what we are doing. We're in a battle between back to life and the reality. The reality is the death march of black white as we watch it. The COVID-19 numbers are truly grim, and all of you know that. We have all seen these numbers. First, you got the number of cases. We saw those numbers, and they rose every day. And then we saw the number of tests being done versus the number of people who have tested positive, and the number of hospitalizations versus the declining number of hospital beds. Those numbers were horrendous. Then came the projected death count, animated by its exponentiating curves. And we kept seeing those charts and those graphs, and we began to see the climatic peaks and the prospective plunges of numbers. We saw the skyrocketing graph of the sharp rise of unemployment, the inverse of the stock market, while the numbers circulated without faces or names. Some began to see, however, that a disproportionate number of the people whose numbers represented were black. Though the United States has always failed to generate numbers with any type of integrity, the numbers we have reveal, though, however, that black people are dying of COVID-19 at a disproportionate high rate. We had two very powerful medical professionals on our program in the past, Dr. Jenny James and Dr. Pat McManus, former health commissioner of Milwaukee, and they talked about those numbers and the proportionate numbers involving African people. So black people would be mourning and marching and resisting the streets as we have done for 500 years or more on behalf of our dead and for our survival. I don't know about you, my brothers and sisters. I'm tired of seeing the teddy bears and the flowers and all of the posts that are up and around us. I'm tired of seeing the cries and welting of parents and mothers over their children and the Facebook posts of black death. I've even had to post a few myself, but these are things that have worked with us. And it makes one think a little bit about the same type of numbers and figures when during the years of the transatlantic slave trade. And I can imagine what those numbers were like compared to what these numbers that we see. So from the earliest days of the slave trade, Europeans always recognized that trafficking humans across the Atlantic posed a public health threat that could jeopardize. I have to turn the mic off of this for those that do come on and make the noise you can hear in the background. I'm sorry about that. But anyway, they have always known that. And so from the earliest days of the slave trade, Europeans recognized that trafficking humans across the Atlantic was a public health threat that could jeopardize their fledgling sentiments. So as we look at COVID-19 and look at the transatlantic slave trade, we're seeing some of the same behavior among the Europeans. When the first smallpox outbreak struck the Americas in the 1500s, the Spanish friars of the Catholic Church would write back and talk about, as they were requesting the Africans, that they would have to take precautions to ensure that the captive Africans did not carry large outbreaks that could wipe out the colonists. And so we began to see the language during the years of in captivity, and the same language that we see today about who should get what and what is public health and who is the public health and who's not. Very clearly, during the transatlantic slave trade, we were not considered the public. And so that language is still coded into all of these messages. And we want to talk about some of that tonight and talk about that language. And so the Western rationalization that engendered slavery, as you talk about quantifying and commodifying this data, black people, both living and dead, have always been a part of the largest and the larger numbers. This history is always with us. And then even as we move to the 20th century, and I'm not going to go into too much detail with that, it continued. When they were building the Panama Canal back in the early end of the 19th century, the early part of the 20th century, most of the workers that were digging up the Panama Canal were Caribbeans, West Indians, from places like Trinidad and Barbados and others. They were coming to work on those and on that canal because obviously it was a source of income and they needed the income to do that. But it was horrific. 25,000 people died in building the Panama Canal. Of the 25,000 died, 80% were African Americans. How this was shown and how it was portrayed in the newspaper is totally different than what I'm saying right now. And then as we look, for instance, even now at this COVID-19, and we go into sort of microcosm cases of this, the first 12 people to die in St. Louis, Missouri, you know, which was a city already plagued by black death, police brutality, and all of that. 12 people, the first 12 people, 70% of them were African Americans. 70% of the deceased in Louisiana, African Americans. But those are not the figures that we get when we look at the paper and when we look at the reports. And so that's why we have to come together ourselves. Because you do have your social scientists, you do have your scholars who are of African-American descent who are looking at this totally different. I just had an opportunity to attend a conference on Sunday, teleconference on Sunday, as they talked about this among black therapists and psychologists and psychiatrists. And they were talking about the trauma and what's going to be left from this and the impact that this awful situation is going to have, you know, on our people. And so as you began to look through and you see this, what we call again, this death march take place. And then when you look at situations like have happened here in Milwaukee recently, with some of the domestic violence issues that are raising up and all of this results of people having to be confined in places together very tightly, which they didn't have room even when they could get out and move about. But now they all got to live compact together like sardines in a can, and what the impact of that might be. So tonight I've asked three beautiful young brothers from our community to come forward, and I've asked them to come and let's talk a little bit about this whole situation. Right now we are hearing from the administrative federal level, the whole quest to open up and let everybody back out, go back to work, get back on the streets. They have closed down, as you know, most of the cities have closed, and there's been the system of confinement in place, but now there's talk of opening up. And then the question becomes, I mean, is this thing over? Is the virus done? Who's making that decision? Who said do that? Why are you doing that? And so many of the other questions that we may ask from that. And so tonight we want to talk about that. We want to look at the political idea behind this. There's obviously the health, and then there's the political. What is the deal behind, who's behind this political stuff? Who's the one that's making the decisions to open up? Who made the decision to open the Florida beaches and have everybody go to the beaches and come together as a crowd? Who made the decision to open the barbershops, beauty salons, and so forth of Georgia? Now, we know the governor did, but where is the support? Who was supporting that? And we just kind of want to look at, you know, how it's all done to kind of understand that. And hopefully none of us will make that mistake and not have a valid picture and image of what's going on. And so we have some folks that can talk about that who have professionally worked in that area and know where those decisions are being made. And we also want to address some of the rumors out here. There's a lot of rumor, as always. And then there's the conspiracy theory stuff. Sometimes it's valid, sometimes it's not. But we need to talk about bioterrorism, if that's possible. Russia is doing some very strange things right now in the world. They're sending submarines at the bottom of the ocean, messing with cable, with the internet cables and wires. Who's in that? North Korea. We don't know whether Sung Jong-un is dead or alive. We keep talking about that and where it's being hidden and what their role might have been in this whole COVID-19. And then, obviously, this opening up in areas of where there's a heavy concentration of African-Americans. What's the idea behind that? So we want to talk about all of those and understand this flow. So I've asked a good brother who I've known a long time, worked with him, and organizations like 100 Black Men, and we've done some mighty, mighty, mighty powerful stuff. And I've asked him, I started out with him first, and I asked him to come forward. I'm looking for Brother Terrence now on his number, but here we are. And I asked him, his name is Terrence Ray. He is a former administrative assistant to a U.S. congressman. And he has some details that I'm going to, we're going to ask him to talk about. So first of all, good afternoon, Brother Terrence.
Hey, Hotep, Dr. Rogers, how you doing, my brother?
Thank you, my brother. I appreciate you so much for coming on. This is going to be a wonderful conversation, and we've got some good people here that are going to participate. I also asked the young brother that I have known. I haven't known him a long time, but we worked together in the Fatherhood Initiative. That was done here in Milwaukee. Was spearheaded by my brother Terrence. He was the director in charge of the Malehood Initiative, and we got together at the time I was working for Bishop Daniels over at Holy Redeemer. I was the director of their social service program, and he came over, and we had one of the first male initiatives at Holy Redeemer. And so he and I got a chance to talk and have a good conversation. He has a very specialty position in health. I'm going to let him tell you a little bit about what that is and what it means. But first of all, just let me greet him. Good afternoon, Brother Marshall. How are you doing?
Well, good evening, Dr. Rogers. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Thank you.
And I look forward to the discussion. And just for clarification, I was brought in by Terrence Ray as a program chair for the Milwaukee Fathers Initiative. Well over 10 years ago. So it's a pleasure to to be in Terrence's circle, and it's really an honor to reconnect with you. So looking forward to the discussion.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much. And then our last guest is by no means a stranger to the Black Reality Think Tank. He is my very dear friend. He's a very good supporter, strong figure in the community. He and I have been, since I've been back to Milwaukee, he and I have been working on many, many projects together. Maybe get a chance that he can talk a little bit about some of the ones that he's doing. He's working on an elders council, and he has a brilliant mind. And I'm just so happy to be able to bond with him and get out here and do some of the work that we do in our community. I'm going to let him tell you a little bit. He is a licensed clinical psychotherapist. He can tell you a little bit about his work. But he's, as I said, he's a dear friend to all of us. Brother Alfonso Watkins, hello, my brother.
Peace and blessings to you, Baba.
Thank you.
It's always a pleasure to be with you and be with Black Reality Think Tank and have the opportunity of speaking to the universe with the family. Looking forward to sharing this platform with Brother Curtis and Brother Mr. Ray. So once again, it's a pleasure to be with y'all. And once again, looking forward to the conversation. Peace and blessings.
Peace and blessings to you. Thank you, my brother. Well, as Jamie Foxx said in the Ray Charles movie, let's make it do what it do. Brother Terrence, let me start with you. Who in the world, who makes the decision in a health issue like this that we're facing to do something like tell folks to go back out, it's okay? Where would that come from? And what would be some of the political motivations behind that? Kind of explain that for us first.
Well, from my experience, actually there are multiple people involved in the decision, but the ultimate decision is made by the governor at the state level. And he, you know, connects or communicates with advisors at the state level, you know, people in his cabinet, and again, that decision is made at the state level. But I actually would like to defer a little bit to Curtis on that one, too, because it does, again, it does emanate from the state level, just all of the particulars involved in a decision like that, because especially considering that it's something that we're currently, you know, embraced in right now.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Okay, Brother Marshall, first of all, could you explain exactly? I know you are a part of a health equity agency. You're a consultant for a health equity. Could you explain a little bit what that is and then maybe take a shot at that question about what the decision process for opening up people to get back out into this deadly killer?
Okay, since you brought up, you know, the term equity, I think it's clear that we all have an understanding on what health equity is. Particularly as it pertains to health equity. Health equity is just a system that assures that everyone is as healthy as they choose to be. I always explain it as you don't give everyone the same thing. You give individuals and families what they need. When you give everyone the same thing, that's basically equality. But equity is when you give individuals and populations and communities resources that they need to better themselves, you know, particularly themselves and their health. Now, just for clarification, I'm a health consultant with RGM agency, which Terrence Ray is the founder and president of. But I've been working in public health, statewide public health, for almost 30 years. And when you look at decisions that are made, particularly in the environment that we're in now, so many people think that the governor makes these decisions just kind of, you know, off the cuff and without any professional content experts around the table. But there's just so many, I mean, there's a whole collage of experts around the table. There are experts in the field of epidemiology, in the field of health equity and resilience and data that really do advise the governor on decisions and when those decisions should be made. So there's a process. It's just not a one-day process, but there's a lot of thought given into the policies and guidelines that are made at what we call the state EOC, the State Center of Emergency Operations. So again, it takes some time to make those decisions. But again, sometimes those decisions may have some political purpose behind them. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, those decisions are made really in the best interest, you know, of the citizens of Wisconsin.
Okay, so then there is some consideration. So the governor might want to do that. Because I understand from what I've been hearing again, and that you have to walk careful when you deal with the news, is that the president wants to make this happen. He had encouraged all of the governors to move forward, even to the point where the Secretary of Justice Barr wanted to talk about fining the states if they don't do it. So,
right.
So I guess there's some push also from the federal level, correct? Is that also how it happens?
Yeah, I mean, I cannot dismiss that. Yes, there is a push from the federal level, but we have to understand that the federal government's role in a pandemic is really to support the states in their responses to an emergency preparedness issue. If we talk about the stockpile, the national stockpile, the federal role is to support and supply the states what they need in order to respond. Wisconsin, fortunately, is a home rule state, as most states are. So really the responsibility in the response really rests on the state government. So again, like in Wisconsin, a lot of situations, a lot of decisions that are made are really governed by state statute and by state law. And that's why right now in Wisconsin, you know, the extension of the stay-at-home order is in the Supreme Court because the legislature, they're challenging right. the governor's authority right. to make those decisions. Mm-hmm. And that's right. where you get some, that's the political side of it. But again, I think that this country is very, very fortunate that the response basically in each state is headed by the governor. And the federal government cannot come in and supersede the governor's authority.
Okay. So yeah. what William Barr was talking about was not real. That can't happen, right? He was going to come in and force the governors to make these
yes.
decisions.
No. I would. This is my personal opinion. I would categorically say no. The president cannot do that.
Okay. All right. All right. That's good.
And Doc, that's where you're getting a lot of push, and that's where it gets into those murky political waters. You know, because most of it is determined at the state level, and so then you get into, you know, what particular party is in charge, and for instance, like here in Wisconsin, the Republicans are in charge of the state, and you know, decisions get made along party lines, and that's when things get to, you know, trickle down and start impacting people. Quite frankly, personally.
Right. Okay. So,
but I think we really have to understand that a lot of this is driven by not only politics but economics as well, and some of it is even mandated by personal lifestyle.
Right.
Because again, Terrence and I were having a conversation the other night, and I said to him, I said, so I'm thinking people really value their lifestyle over their lives themselves. Without a life, that you have no lifestyle. So I think that because you have individuals that are protesting because they are saying they're even trying to compare the stay at home to being a slave in slavery, right?
Okay.
So there's a lot that's kind of driving that. So when it comes, you know, personal lifestyle and economics and political side, then it begins to kind of really force the governor's hand or even force the hand of the state legislature, as in the case of Wisconsin.
Oh, that's interesting. So, other words, a lot of people, you know, like you said, they want their lifestyle. They want to go fishing. I saw something by some people from Illinois came over to Wisconsin to go up there in the lakes and fish, and they had their boats out there and so forth and so on, violating those rules there. And so they were. They wanted to respond to the lifestyle that they live. They want to go fishing. They want to do things like that in the springtime. People are out in the lakefront jogging.
Right. You know. That's so true, Doctor. I have colleagues of mine that live all over the state of Wisconsin, and they were just telling me they live up in the Rhinelander area and the Northwoods, and they're telling me that they're seeing a lot of Illinois license tags up in the Northwoods, and normally you don't see that until close to Memorial Day, the end of May.
Right. Okay. All right. Okay. Now, let me ask this. Since we're talking about that legislative federal state or rules and regulation, how is that? What act, can you kind of explain to us what happened when the governor issued this mandate that to postpone the election, the primary, because of the virus and the closeness? And the fact that Wisconsin, Milwaukee in particular, they only had 5 polls open to service, 600,000-700,000 people. And that was overturned. Explain that for me a little bit. I know what I heard to be some of the rules and that they used to overturn that, that he could not create an executive order regulating voting rights and things like that. But is that how that worked? I mean, is that what happened to your knowledge in terms of, you know, working in that field?
Well, I wasn't involved in that discussion or those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of happened over the course of a day, Doctor. And I'm not really
okay.
clear. And Terrence may be able to speak, you know, to that more. But that's more on the political side.
Right. So that was strictly a political piece that had nothing to do with health, safety, or any of that. That was strictly politics.
Yeah, strictly. And it was, you know, it was so, you know, confusing, man, because it involved the City of Milwaukee Elections Commission, but then it also involved an aspect of the state as well, because the secretary, I think, of the Department of Health and Social Services, or Health and Human Services, was involved in the decision. And then it actually rose all the way up to the Supreme Court, who made a decision almost like overnight that impacted the decision for the election to trickle back down to the Elections Commission to say, okay, you know, we're going to allow people to go out to vote, where we started out with 180 polling sites, and, you know, like overnight we ended up with 5 polling sites. So okay. It got murky again in that political arena.
Okay, all right.
And if I can go out and say that, I think that a lot of it was driven by the fact that, you know, there was an election, there was a seat up for election, re-election on the state Supreme Court. The candidate was backed by President Trump, and it was a ploy, I think, to, in my personal opinion, to really marginalize the African-American vote so that that, you know, seat would remain as it was.
Okay, okay. So here we go again, disenfranchisement and all of these things that would stop African-American voice.
Exactly. Yeah, right. How do you go? And I'm still asking the question: how do you go from 180 polling sites down to 5 polling sites?
Yeah, 5. That was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever heard. I never heard anything like that. You know. And my argument is: how did our community allow that to happen? Never mind politics and.
And when you consider the contentious nature of the election, that particular election where, you know, you had Sister Lena Taylor running against the incumbent Tom Barrett, you know, I mean, the conspiracy theories, you know, abound. You know, the opportunity, and when you looked at across the board, the black candidates who were running. We had a black candidate for mayor, a black candidate for county executive, right. A black candidate for city treasurer. You know, I mean, and when you think about all those positions, the city and the county could have been locked down, literally, you know, or at least had black representation at the helm.
Right. Exactly. And so they were trying to assure that that wouldn't happen, even though a lot of it did happen, you know, but.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And I mean, one and another one I've neglected to mention, and as far as the way I think it was a major position, another candidate was for the comptroller, you know, who handled, you know, is involved with the overall city budget, you know. So you look at all of those positions and. You know, you see what happened. That's one theory of how we could go from 180 down to 5 polling sites.
Okay. All right. Okay, let me ask this. I know my brother Alfonso has been real quiet. I'm going to come to you in just a minute, Brother Alfonso. But I want to ask this. I had given you some things that I thought we wanted to talk about, some talking points I sent you. And here's one of the ones that I really, really want to address. And I think all three, I mean, obviously you're not a part of the people who developed the charts and the charters of how a nation is to be run. But America has always been known as coded as the most powerful nation on the planet Earth. It is militarily stronger than any of the other ones, they say. And I do say they say. They have obviously weapons of mass destruction that could actually wipe the complete planet of the Earth off. How in the world, what was missing that a bunch of germs could come in here and take the whole thing down? What was missing from this country's framework, from its structure, that it couldn't, first of all, see that that was a possibility, And then second of all, be able to combat something like that very quickly. From any of your experiences working in government and in a community, what do you think was missing from this country that could cause that?
Well, Dr. Rogers, if I could speak to that a little bit. You know, I've been in public health a long time, and I was in public health even during the H1N1 outbreak in 2009.
Okay.
And there are really distinct differences between the current pandemic and the H1N1, the swine flu, and even the Ebola. In 2009, the H1N1 pandemic, it was caused by a type of a virus that scientists already had a vaccine for. So that was not really a problem. And by contrast, there's no vaccine for the coronavirus. I mean, and that's new. I mean, that's new, and it's more deadly than the swine flu. But then we look at even the Ebola, on the other hand, even though it had a higher mortality rate than the coronavirus does right now, it's far less transmittable. So, again, so you have to really, it's hard to compare, you know, those types of outbreaks with a pandemic, particularly one that's easily passed or that's defined as a respiratory illness, which is much easily and more transmittable between animals to human or between human to human. So another point I want to make is that in public health is always continuing to prepare for emergency preparedness. I don't care if it's the flu, a flood, or anthrax, or whatever it may be. And public health, along with partners, they do these tabletop exercises, you know, to exercise their plans and their response. But see, the thing about that is that it's difficult to really plan and prepare for really the unknown, because you can spend years and years preparing for a pandemic, but yet that pandemic may not never occur. And I remember when back during H1N1 that the whole public health messages was to wash your hands, cover your mouth, kind of the same messages that we're saying now, right? And so we were expecting like thousands and thousands of individuals to really die from H1N1. But because of the public health messages out there, the mortality rate wasn't anything near as to what was predicted. So again, you can't prepare, but then there's no guarantee that what you are preparing for is something that you would actually have to respond to. So again, there's a number of factors. There's not any one reason why, you know, this country was not prepared. You can say now that when you look at the World Health Organization, right?
Yes.
In January, the World Health Organization, they deemed the coronavirus as a public health threat, but yet it wasn't until like the middle of March that it was deemed to be a worldwide pandemic. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking that, you know, my personal opinion is that if that had been determined before March, then perhaps then those that, you know, at the CDC, those at the National Institutes of Infectious Diseases and Allergies would have been able to begin to prepare and garner those resources and to convince the federal government, particularly the person at the White House, to really focus on it and say, this is happening, this is real. So again, mm-hmm. I mean, there was some squashing of the messages that need to come forth to the public that the federal government did not allow to happen.
Right.
So I'm just saying that there's always preparedness. I mean, there's always, you know, initiatives to prepare and funding, but it's hard to prepare for something that you don't know if it's going to become reality or not.
Okay.
And Father, part of politics is really ain't my lane, so that's why I don't really have much to say about that. But from a military and war perspective, I think we have to recognize what was happening and what was going on on the planet at the time of this pandemic.
Right.
The continent of Africa, our brothers and sisters on the continent are waking up, and they are starting to have a real focused conversation about the United States of Africa. America and the European powers were looking for a war, and Iran did not respond the way that they expected Iran to respond.
Mm-hmm.
So they needed to create a smoke screen to once again to interfere with what's happening on the continent of Africa. So just from my personal perspective, it's not that America was not prepared. They didn't want to be prepared. They needed a distraction to create, I'm going to say, an atmosphere to interfere with what's happening on the continent of Africa, because our brothers and sisters are waking up. So I'm saying, from a military and war perspective, that's the way I'm looking at it, because I'm a former Marine. So there's some things that, once again, I think we are being distracted as it relates to why this pandemic was allowed to take this type of impact in the United States. They could have prepared for this. Many of our people in the States, we were already exposed to this virus. Many brothers and sisters were sick in October, in November, with these signs and symptoms. So for them to say that they didn't know about it until January and February is not accurate, man. So I think, once again, we are being distracted about the reality of what's happening on the planet.
Okay. So, in other words, this is a whole nother global piece that's tied not only into the political, but the whole psychology of domination and oppression and all of that. So that's kind of where you're going with that, correct?
Yeah. It's a form of, once again, it's psychological warfare.
Yeah.
But once again, it's on an international level.
Okay.
We have to remember that America has gone through two or three reconstructions. And this third reconstruction is the once again, the conspiracy theory is the New World Order.
Okay.
So there's a reboot or a reset that has taken place, but that reset is actually caused, from my perspective, for the reality of what's happening on the continent of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of the resources that are needed to manufacture so many products and so many industries are coming out of the continent of Africa, and our brothers and sisters are running them Europeans out of Africa.
Right.
They're running them, the French, the Portuguese, the Belgians, they're running them out of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So they needed something to interfere with that process.
Right. And also, as you said,
point is that a lot of the resources that are necessary to make the pharmaceuticals that we use every day, you know, even some as simple for the common cold, come out of Africa, but then they minimize that and always, you know, refer to China as being the medicine cabinet of the world.
Yeah.
And when this all began in Wuhan, there was concern that the products needed to produce pharmaceuticals coming out of China, that supply chain would be broken because of the coronavirus, which really began in China. So again, I mean, that's another point that I'd like to make, is that, I mean, that's just a way that they just minimize the importance of our home country, Africa, as being, you know, as instrumental in the healthcare system that we, most of us, have access to today in this country.
Right. And then they use money.
So I hear supply chain and global perspective, but I also see consistent and direct lines, you know, made to economic issues, man. It's all about the dollar at the end of the day.
Always about the dollar. Yeah, you're right. It's always the economics. And like you said, as you look at China, it has completely inundated Africa. Looking at something today where China had lent one of those countries $5 billion, $10 billion. He's giving the check back. He said he don't want it because it carries with it too many, other things.
And Bubba, when you even think about the minerals, and that's needed to make the cell phone.
Right.
That comes out in Africa. Comes out of the continent of Africa. When you think about, once again, like Brother Curtis was saying, a lot of the pharmaceutical drugs that are being used are coming out of Africa. So when we talk about economics, we're talking about all of the resources that the continent of Africa has that's manufactured, that create all of these industries that other countries are benefiting from. But once again, our brothers and sisters are saying they're taking back control of those resources.
Right, exactly.
So we have to look at this, once again, when we say America wasn't prepared. No, America could have been prepared for this.
Right.
But once again, they chose not to be prepared.
And don't forget that all of the uranium and plutonium and all of that material that's necessary for nuclear construction also comes out of Africa. And even the use of a lot of this technology that we're using now, cell phones and all of that come, those resources are over there in Mozambique and places like that, and which is where you always find the trouble. Okay, I want to open up the lines to our audience in a few minutes, but before I do, I want to talk about this one thing that we haven't touched on. I think you have always 2 hours is not enough to get into all the details of it, but you have definitely raised some very powerful issues that help us understand the difference in the politics versus the health and so forth. The one thing that I wanted to ask about, we all know that are here online, we know about that horrendous situation that took place a couple of days ago over in Milwaukee on 12th Street, where a brother killed his family, shot 5 people. I don't know all the details of it. Maybe some of you do know what some of the details of that was. But the question that I want to ask out of that, can one make an argument that this COVID-19 is connected to some of the behavior that we're seeing? Because you talk about things slowing down and people going inside. Well, crime is not slowing down. And then some of the horrendous behavior of the crime is not slowing down as well. So I'm going to ask you, Brother Alfonso, you are the psychotherapist. Can we equate some of the stress and pain of this death march of black people first, and then some of the stress of this COVID and the economic problems it's going to produce? Can that be linked directly? I know it can be linked indirectly, but can we link that directly to some of that?
Baba, the COVID is just exposing and magnifying the conditions of all of the black cities in this country. We are under always this continuous traumatic stress circumstances for us. We always under stress. In this circumstance, this pandemic, this crisis has heightened that. And so we are, it's like being hyper-vigilant out of, we're in a very hyper-vigilant state of survival. And many of our people have not acquired the necessary stress mechanism or cope mechanisms to deal with this level of stress. So we're responding in ways that are self-destructive and very harmful to ourselves and to our people. So when we think about the environmental and social toxicity of racism, racism is the virus, family. We can't continue to not identify what is the source of what this problem is. So the COVID once again is creating or exposing the conditions that we live in within the context of the social and health disparities of all the inner cities that we are that we live in. So from a mental health perspective or from a psychological development perspective, our people don't have the necessary, once again, coping skills or stress resources, the internal and external components necessary to function under this type of level of stress.
Yeah. And
you know, if I could say, I really appreciate that, you know, Alfonso, because I was just reading that they were saying that obviously that was a low-income neighborhood. They always make it a point to say it's a low-income neighborhood, right? And about 30% of the families in that neighborhood live in poverty. So those individuals, they really are not thriving. They aren't living. They are surviving. They're in a constant survival mode. And that does take its toll, right? So when you are surviving, meaning that tells me that you have, like, the minimum resources. So if you already have a low-wage paying job, and that job is snatched from you because of a layoff or your business closing, then that's going to add to the stress. And particularly in households where you have multi-generations of families living together in close proximity.
Right,
because,
right,
again,
right,
the parks are closed. That's closed. You can't go to the Boys and Girls Club, the YMCA, places that may have been used as a way to escape and to kind of digress and kind of, you know, come back to a sense of feeling good about yourself or just being able to make it from day to day. So when that's taken away from you, then what do you have? And then there's a negative label that African Americans just don't listen, and African Americans just going to do what they want to do.
Okay.
And it's easy for someone to say that, particularly if you help the resources, if you still go to the park, in the suburbs, and get in your car and take a drive. That's easy for you to say that someone is not listening just because they don't have the resources that you have in order to survive in the environment that we're all living in now.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, today there was some information coming from Department of Social Services that there's a high level of increase of domestic violence since all of this has taken place in terms of, again, looking at those number things, quantifying poverty, and trying to look at it from a number perspective. Instead, like you said, instead of addressing it like we need to address it, they try to address it based on numbers. And
right.
And so, and again, we are seeing some ugly stuff coming out of that. I know, Brother Alfonso, you're a part of that, community emergency team that goes.
The Office of Violence Prevention has a crisis response team that they call out to respond to crises like that.
So what are you seeing when you go out there on these calls like that?
Well, most of the time, once again, those are the type of calls that we get. I mean, when people have violence, or domestic violence, murder, gunshots, people being shot. So those are the things that we respond to. But back to your original question about what this one individual did, we have to begin to recognize how brothers are transitioning into the manhood and not necessarily acquiring, once again, the necessary coping skills to handle stress. So the little bit that we know about this brother, he has a history of domestic violence. So once again, his history is that he's a violent type of brother. But when brothers are thrown into that situation of being incarcerated for a long period of time, they're underdeveloped in their maturation and their maturity. So they they don't necessarily acquire the necessary skills to handle stress, to handle frustration.
Okay.
So their only power is to be violent. So we have to look at what are we doing in our socialization of our brothers and sisters to help them acquire the necessary skills to function in this society. Because we have to recognize that the structure or institution of racism is designed to underdevelop us.
Right.
So we have to start looking at this through a different lens and taking ownership of how we are socializing or allowing ourselves to be socialized under racism.
Okay.
Right. And it's very concerning to me. It's very concerning when I know that the numbers that are coming from the Department of Social Services. But what's more concerning to me, and it should be more concerning to everyone, are the domestic violence cases that are not being reported, because you have a lot of people that are suffering in silence.
Right.
And they
right.
don't report their right. own calls. So right. to me, I right. think that should be more concerning than right. those that just knowing the right. numbers that I reported.
Right.
Right. That's a great point, Curtis. I noticed speaking of numbers, I noticed the other day there was some numbers put out that the incidences of domestic violence had rose about, I think it was between 25 or 28%. And the first thing I immediately thought about, you know, when you consider what this pandemic has created, you know, where you got people basically under house arrest, you know, and schools are closed, kids are in the house, and we're moving to a new normal. I mean, I immediately thought about the incidences of domestic violence that aren't in fact being reported. So,
right.
therefore, those numbers are probably much more higher than 28%.
Okay, and let me ask this too, and then we're going to go right to our break for a minute and get to our audience. And all of you saw the media coverage of that incident, right? Correct? Did all three of you see that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Did you notice that 90% of the people, the crowd that had gathered, nobody was wearing masks, nobody was wearing gloves, they were all close
right.
together? What did you think of that?
I thought about the previous Friday up in Madison, where there was a rally to oppose the extension of the stay-at-home order. and there were close to 2,000-3,000 people up there, vast majority white. Nobody was 6 feet respecting the 6 feet distance rule, or the vast overwhelming majority of them, nobody had masks on.
Yeah, including the police. The police didn't have it on.
Yeah, and I was just juxtaposing the two when the media showed the neighborhood around where this incident occurred. You know, and that was the gist of the story. You know, it was almost downplayed. The horrific crime was almost downplayed by the focus that was put on the fact that nobody had masks and gloves on.
Right.
That's what I thought about.
Yeah, including the police officers.
When I saw that, to me, what came to mind was that this was a horrific crime. Normally, in neighborhoods like that, you know, people are close. People know one another, right?
Yes.
And right. I was thinking about how traumatized that neighborhood was.
Yes.
Where at that moment, then Corona-19 was not important to them. This
exactly.
was a horrific crime right there in their neighborhood. Forget COVID-19.
Right.
I'm thinking about five people killed in my neighborhood.
In one house.
So I'm thinking that to me, and Alfonso, I don't know if you know, would agree or not, but I'm thinking that just really goes to show how traumatized that community was
That's
at that time.
That's
and forget the mask. Who thought about the mask, the gloves? I need to go. This is in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
And what the term, I mean, for the diagnosis, continuous traumatic stress syndrome. Continuous traumatic stress syndrome. We are constantly under stress, so we ain't scared of COVID. There's a whole lot of other stuff out here that we're dealing with, so COVID really ain't what we scared of. You know, so it's not impacting us, our reality.
I agree with that.
Yeah, we're constantly dealing with death and trauma, so we ain't functioning like that. So in other conversations, I think we have to start not really having – is not paying attention to what some Europeans are doing. They doing what they do. That's their history, y'all. They have always functioned on that. They not scared of death. They are some fearless species. That's a fearless species. So when they up there marching about, that ain't our business. We need to put all our focus and our attention on what we going to do when we come out of this COVID.
I like that.
So that's just my perspective, because they going to do what they do.
Right.
They gonna do
what right.
They're
I agree.
They gonna, yeah. So we spending too much time talking about them, fam.
Yeah. Okay.
Let them Caucasians do what they do. That's what they do.
Okay.
I agree.
All right. Let's.
They got 400 years of experience of being marginalized. Yeah. They can't deal with it for a month.
Yeah.
It's so funny at the beginning of Doc at the intro of your piece, Doc. The sister you had on that offered some. Ways to eliminate the stress.
Right.
One of her primary points was decrease the amount of news you pay attention to.
There you go.
that contributes to the stress.
Right, exactly. Okay, let's take a quick break, and we're going to come right back and open up to our audience, see what they have to say, if they have questions. We'll just take a break. We'll be right back.
What hurt us most was when we bought into the socialization process. Let me tell you what that is. Socialization is where you get your ideas, your principles, and your concepts on how to live your life. Okay? What we call integration was white people, so-called white people, primarily Jewish people, who sold us a perspective on life called integration. See, it wasn't just that word. It was perspective on life called integration that said, partner with us white folks and you're going to be all right. Hadn't been in a hostile relationship with white folks so long and had suffered at the end of it, we were looking for relief, so we were willing to partner thinking we were creating a new humanity. But what happened, we were disarmed in the war. We were disarmed. And so the same people who were asking us to do this was the primary retailers in all black communities across America. The same people who were asking us to do this was the ones who was running the school boards and the schools in our community. The same people who were asking us to do this were the very people who was controlling the music industry. The same people who were asking us to do this was the very people who was controlling the movie industry as it affects us. So these same people were the ones who were the managers of the sports and athletes from the black community. So they're telling us, don't compete with us, integrate with us, but we're running everything. So they're making billions off of us, and we're not making nothing. And what we're saying now, we need to wake up to the reality that it's about ethnicity. Okay? You must do for self, as Elijah Muhammad told us. You know, Malcolm said, black nationalism. People say, oh, I don't want to be that. Define black nationalism, Mr. Malcolm X. He said, black nationalism is owning the economics, politics, and culture where you live, being in control of economic politics and culture where you live. That sounds like Chinatown to me. That sounds like Williamsburg, Brooklyn to me.
Right, right.
That sounds like Little Italy to me. So why can't be Little Black or Little Africa? You know what I'm saying? If we're going to compete with some people in an economic process, we can't play by rules that's different from the rules that make the game. You can't go on a basketball court with a football in your hand and think you're going to run the 100-yard dash. That ain't going to work. You're going to lose at that basketball game every time. So you got to find out what the rules of the economic game is, and then you have to learn how to play it better than the person that's in the game with you. And what we're learning about economics, at the end of the day, the motivation for economics is the need to provide food, clothing, shelter, safety, and security for ourselves and our family. See, we can talk all this other stuff. Well, I got a degree because I want to go to college. I want to be a doctor. I want to be a lawyer. Why? You want to make money. Why do you want to make money? Because I've got to buy some food. I got to buy some clothing, I got to afford some shelter, and I want to provide safety for my family. So that's the bottom line. And if that is the bottom line, you got to be in control of that. You can't depend on someone else to deliver that to you. And so what Happy is going to try to show is how to develop black businesses, how to manage black businesses, how to organize black people around the management and the marketing of black economic enterprises where we live, especially in the United States of America, but anywhere in the world we happen to be today, where we control the retail and the wholesale that affects us. If you see the little Arabs in our community, you see all Arabs are working in the stores. The guy that comes with that little box truck to deliver the produce to the stores, they're all Arabs. The little warehouse that the box truck picked up from, which is now at the wholesale end of that retail chain, they're all Arabs. That's the way you do it. The problem with that picture is the consumer that's giving all those Arab guys work so they can make money and go home and take care of their families are all black folks. You see? And at the same time, we're giving all those consumer dollars to this community. Our young men and women are standing on the street because there's no store for them to go and get a job in. There's no retail business in the community that they can work in that they own because other ethnic groups are hiring their own people so that they can provide the food, clothing, shelter, safety, and security for themselves. I'm not anti-anybody. We're not anti-anybody. We just pro-black folks being to feed, clothe, and shelter themselves. And you cannot do this if you're so naive and you're so ignorant, you give the best of your capital away to someone else who's trying to do the same thing for themselves.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
The following is a public service announcement from the Black Reality Think Tank.
It is customary in African tradition for me to ask the elders to speak. May I speak?
Speak.
My name is Alfonso Watkins. I am a licensed clinical psychotherapist here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I have been asked to share some information pertaining to the catastrophic and pandemic situation that we are experiencing in the black community throughout the country, as well as on the planet. The times that we are living in is very critical from a mental health perspective and as well as a spiritual perspective to tap into your relationship to your creator or to our creator. and understanding that we have had or have been through many of these pandemics and catastrophic situations before. So we have the necessary coping mechanisms and survival skills to do and to survive through this. So it's important that you begin to spend more time meditating, praying, practicing some of our traditional things as it relates to our traditional religions and getting in tune with our ancestral consciousness. So those are some of the things that I would suggest that individuals need to practice and acquire to get through this process. And we are praying that those individuals who have lost loved ones during this difficult time, that the Creator and the ancestors bless you and give you the strength and the wisdom to persevere through this. And so it's important that you practice and listen to some of the many of the necessary things that the professionals, doctors are requiring that you practice to survive through this. So once again, thank you for the opportunity to speak.
All right, my brothers and sisters, we are back. We thank Dr. James Smalls for his remarks at the break. And he's really speaking truth. This is what we've been talking about. And basically, we really look at it, bottom line is we got to recapture the African mind. And I've got a brother that I'm going to call on, open up with our first caller, who wrote a book on recapturing the African mind. He's a good friend of mine, my buddy. Dr. Bruce Bridges from Durham, North Carolina. Good afternoon, Dr. Bridges. How are you today?
What's up, my brother?
Great. Want to add something to this conversation?
Yeah. Can you hear me okay? Because I'm on the cell phone tonight. Am I okay? Am I coming through clear?
Yeah, I can hear real clear.
Okay, good, good. Yeah, good. First of all, thank you for applauding my book and letting people know about it, because it really is, whenever I hear people like Dr. Small speaking and what we're talking about on the program tonight, I'm definitely on point in terms of us getting our minds back, because anything that we have been talking about tonight and in terms of what Dr. Small talked about in the commercial, the recorded session with Dr. Small, it's all about getting our minds back and doing for self and thinking. And you can't do for self until you think for self, because action... thought precedes action. So you have to get that mind back first. Then we can start doing what Dr. Small was talking about. You got to get your mind back first. So I'm basically listening and definitely agreeing with what most people are saying. And I've been out today and I met everybody like y'all were talking. And then you're all in Milwaukee, I think the brothers are. But I'm in Durham, North Carolina, and people are wearing masks. And I had on one and wearing gloves, and it's really something else, man, what is out there. And we won't get into it right now, but I'm sure, Dr. Raj, you got some of the information I have, some of the videos about how this whole thing was designed in the laboratory and what it's all designed to do. So I'm just about tired of talking about it. But, you know, I'm basically just listening tonight, and I'm still with you, because you might have some more calls, but I'm still with you.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, my brother. I always appreciate you. You're right. I really would like for you to give me a call if you could one day. I want to talk to you about something. So I would really appreciate it if you would give me a call. Maybe.
Okay, good. Would you give me, when you get a chance, email me your phone number again, okay?
Okay, I sure will, because I definitely want you to call me and talk to you about something. But anyway, appreciate it. Dr. Bruce Bridges, Durham, North Carolina, Recapturing the African Mind. He's done.
Hey, Doc, yes. Can I... You had mentioned earlier that you had attended a conference, a video conference with, black professionals.
Yes.
And giving a black perspective on, basically how to view this or how to deal with this pandemic thing. And I think that's the kind of, if we're going to be bombarded with information, from, a media source, if you will, it needs to be that kind of information.
Yes,
I agree.
In
our community, man. Because that's what we're lacking. We don't get the other side. And like Alfonso said, most of this information, and particularly with respect to the political aspect of it, is merely a distraction, okay, to keep you focused on that while everything else, all the other mayhem is not even being paid attention to.
Well, you know, it's a, and I agree. I totally agree with it. It's a step-by-step process. But you have to do the mirror thing every now and then. You got to get people to look in the mirror and look at what you're looking at. See, they need to see what they need to see. And a lot of times they don't do that. And so some of these kinds of things can be some wake-up messages. Very clearly what you and Brother Curtis and Brother Alfonso have laid out, your grassroots might not see it in that way. So you have to bring that mirror perspective and let them see it that way and see what they're doing. They may not. I don't think, like you said, people were conscious of, I don't have on a mask, I don't have on a gloves. Listen, my people got shot and killed. I'm out here to take care of some business. I ain't thinking about all that mess. And just like when people need to go to work, you know, I'm not staying home. I need to go work. I got to pay my bills. I got to eat. Got to have food. I got to do this. Got to do that. I'm not thinking about COVID-19.
But I think that people really have to want to see it. If they don't want to see it, even looking in the mirror, they're not going to see it.
Yeah, I agree.
And I talk about that in regards to equity. Sometimes I tell people, you know, the colleagues, which are, as Alfonso refers to, as Europeans, right? I say sometimes around equity, you need to go to the bathroom and close the door, look in the mirror, and help come into moment Jesus. Because so many times people say, well, you know, I got mine, you have to get yours. But sometimes in building equity, you have to be willing to give up something in order to bring somebody up to where you are.
Right.
So exactly. Again, and some people, that's where that cognitive dissonance comes in. You know, does it, when it comes face to face with them, when inequities come face to face with them, does it cause that internal conflict? They'll say, you know, I think you should have, you know, a good house and good education and health insurance and all of that. But then when you come face to face with it, when it calls for you to give up something or to make a sacrifice, then are you willing to do that? And I think a lot of people really don't know how to resolve that cognitive dissonance.
There we go.
Okay. You believe one thing, but then your attitude, you know, or your actions are totally opposite of what you believe.
Exactly.
So
there we go. That's what I'm talking
part
about.
Part of that cognitive dissonance is, like the brother just got from, what was his name? Brother
Bruce
wrote the book.
Bruce Bridges, yeah. Dr. Bridges.
That's what we are dealing with. We have to understand the reason we have cognitive dissonance because we are functioning out of a European conceptual belief system. If once we resurrect our African consciousness, our identity is going to be identified through our African culture. So Europeans don't necessarily have an identity crisis because they function out of a European conceptual belief system. We as Africans have to begin to resurrect, once again, like my brother was saying, our African mind.
Okay.
So then we can eliminate the cognitive dissonance.
Very good.
I agree with that. Yeah, that's
very
true.
Good. I agree too. Okay, Brother Pugh, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. How you doing, Brother Pugh, tonight?
Good evening, everybody. This is a question that goes to any of your guests. Since about 2007, the 53206 zip code where those five killings occurred has been regarded as sort of like one of the worst zip codes in America, an indicator of poverty and prisons and all that kind of stuff. But in today's Urban Milwaukee magazine, it points out that the top three leaders in Milwaukee County right now happen to be three 30-year-olds from the zip code 53206. David Crawley, the county executive, Cavalier Johnson, the president of the Common Council, and Marcelia Nicholson, the chairperson of the county board. And so in the light of what Professor Small was saying about ethnicity, and in light of what y'all are saying about not being concerned about what white folks are doing, but rather being focused on what we should do, I'm just interested in what you think are the new possibilities, given the fact that there's going to be some new black leadership.
Okay, anybody?
Those are just some diamonds in the rough, man. There's some brilliant young brothers and sisters in the city of Milwaukee. So once again, that just shows that the conditions that we live in are we still producing positive, productive human beings in this city living under this condition. So hats off to those brothers and sisters, to those the parents that help shape and mold those, to the community that nurtured those three brothers. I mean, the sister and the two brothers. So hats off to our community to produce those type of young people, to put them in leadership. So that's beautiful. But once again, we have to at some point, family, get to start having real conversations about how we are going to socialize our children to their focus to be on how we gonna address the issues of our people. Not what Europeans are doing, what they have done, but how do we begin to create human beings that are focused on addressing the crisis, the conditions, the issues that black people face, and not be part of what Europeans are doing. We need to create our own independent economic, social, and political systems.
You know, that's a great point. I agree with that.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
I totally agree. Yeah.
Yeah, because, so, again.
Go ahead, Kurt.
Again, my point is that, and that's why, you know, when I hear the term new normal, right, what is the new normal for African Americans, for black people? What does that look like? Because my normal may be different than yours. So I think that, and I'm hoping that, you know, COVID-19 will trigger the largest social change in this country since the Civil Rights Movement, since the 60s. And it's going to happen from the ground up. It's not going to happen with the old schools, with those young people, as Alzo was talking to. It has to happen from the ground because, again, COVID has uncovered a lot of inequities. It's brought some light to it, a whole different discussion. You can go online now and find many, 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 many articles about how the social determinants are really driving the morbidity and mortality of COVID in the African-American community. So I'm hoping that regardless of who's downtown on the Common Council, who's on the county board, I'm hoping that young people, as they call them, Gen X or millennials or whoever they are, can really drive that change. But it has to come from the ground, and it has to be a movement and just not a initiative or a coalition. My definition of a movement, once the movement is there, it becomes part of who you are. It's in your heart, it's in your soul, and it's in your spirit. And regardless of who's downtown in City Hall or on the county board, that movement never dies, and that movement will drive change.
Okay.
Couldn't agree more, man. Yeah, good point, Curtis.
All right. Let me go to a couple of other numbers. I'm not sure whether you want to speak or you're just listening. 336, Montgomery, Alabama, 676.
Yeah. Good evening, Dr. Rogers,
good evening.
And good evening to your guests.
Yeah.
To your three guests, thank you so very much for your time and your energies in this conversation. And I want to kind of leap off from what Brother Curtis was mentioning, that we really have to kind of get back to ground level. The question that I have is this a golden opportunity for us as black people to hit that reset button? Hit that reset button either, you know, locally or regionally, some way in which we can start to talk and actually do more healthier lifestyle living. And I allude to going towards plant-based dieting, to urban gardening, things of that nature that would allow for us to take it into our own hands to be more healthier now. Are there marketing strategies or PSAs that can be developed, or maybe you may have had that thought about trying to resurrect or re-channel our mindset towards healthier living? So of the three brothers, I think this would be more along the lines of the public health representative, and I'll just listen. Thank you.
Yeah, you know what? I appreciate that comment, and I totally agree with that. Because, again, you're hearing now how diabetes and obesity and high blood pressure, I mean, these are chronic diseases that disproportionately do affect African Americans, right? And I think now is the time to, like you said, to sit down and think and reset. Okay, how can I take care of myself? But then it kind of goes, you know, beyond the personal responsibility. It goes to the healthcare system. It goes to the state, to the federal level, because again, it's hard to do that if you don't have access, you know, to healthcare. You know, if you just go to a health fair and just screen for high blood pressure and they say that your high blood pressure is off the grid and your BMI is this and that, right? Okay, fine. So I've been screened. So now what do I do and where do I go? So I think now this is the opportunity to not only reset the button in the community among Black folks, you know, for us, but also the system as well, because that's what you're hearing now. You cannot see a news conference where they're talking about how many African Americans are dying from COVID-19 without them also saying, and the reason for that is because of the chronic diseases that are prevalent in our communities, right? So I think it's a good time to do that. And but I think, again, it's up to us, it's up to African Americans to push the reset button. If we have to push it 20 or 30 times, that's what we have to do.
All right. Thank you, Brother Lush, for that question. That was great.
You're welcome, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Let's go over to Brother Herbie White. How are you doing tonight, Brother Herbie?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers, and to all of your guests.
Thank you.
It's a very, very interesting program.
Thank you, sir.
What I'd like to add is the COVID-19 virus and all its implications and the numbers and the spreading and what we need to do and what things should take place, all the information that we're receiving from our enemy.
Oh, that's right.
Wow.
Right.
Our condition in this country from 1619 with slavery to the end of slavery to Jim Crow to convict leasing to the lynchings in 1919 and to the crack epidemic and the drugs and everything, and now COVID is all due to white supremacy. Mm-hmm. It's all connected. It's the COVID virus today. It was AIDS before.
Wow.
It was the Tuskegee experiment. It's all due to white supremacy. We cannot forget that we dealing with our enemy.
That's right.
Yes, sir.
That's right.
Yes.
So our solutions can't be based on what they're telling us. Oh, well, you need to do this, and you need to stop doing that, and you need to get into this, and the COVID virus, and now it's spreading, and now it's not spreading, and don't go over here, and don't go over there. We're following another pattern and walking ourselves right into hell.
Right into death.
They ain't no good now. They ain't never been no good.
You know, I appreciate your comment, and I'm thinking back, you're taking me back to when Dr. Rogers introduced the program. I think we're very fortunate that he's able to bring, you know, individuals that are credible from our community, like Dr. Janine James and Dr. Texan Manis, and others really that are credible, that we can trust, and I do agree with that. I know a wonderful read that you may look into would be Medical Apartheid, which was authored by Dr. Harriet Washington,
yeah,
who's a medical anthropologist.
Mm-hmm.
And she really did catalog very well how, going back over 200 or 300 years, how African Americans and Blacks and slaves and other minorities were unwillingly and unknowingly used for medical experiments. So that distrust is there. But I think that, you know, Dr. Rogers and others have done a wonderful job in bringing, you know, individuals that, you know, are knowledgeable, that are credible, and that are trustworthy from our community to give us these messages and to tell it like it is.
That's right. You got to.
So I appreciate him for doing that, and I applaud his efforts.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank you very much.
And I just want to add one more thing to that. Part of where we, within the context of our cognitive dissonance, is living under white supremacy, racism, has created a personality configuration in us that it hinders our ability to respond to natural circumstances from an organic perspective. And so when we have these conversations, if we are not looking at it from the perspective of our ma'afa, and understanding that these people declared war on us, and they still are we still under attack. Mm-hmm. So we can't be having no puff soft conversations. We got to start talking about this from a war perspective. Because if we don't talk about it from a war perspective, the brain is not going to create the necessary cognitive processes to solve the problem. So now that we can identify that we're at war, we have to start functioning from a war perspective.
Right.
These people are not our friends. They have no love for us.
Never have.
So we can't continue to try to participate in their system the way they got the system set up, because it's not set up for us to participate. So we have to, it's an avoidance, I'm going clinical, it's an avoidance personality disorder, where we are avoiding dealing with the reality of our circumstances.
Right.
We at war, fam.
All right. Let me go over here to Detroit, Michigan, 313-310. Are you listening, or you want to say? Would you like to say something, Carla, or are you just listening? Okay, just listening. Charlotte, North Carolina, 704-605, listening, or you want to say something?
I'm just listening.
All right, thank you. Okay, let's go to my brother from Philadelphia, Brother Timothy. How you doing, brother?
Hey, brother's always good, brother, and I like your guest. You as a host, this is always good. You always come up with solutions. But I'm going to say, sir, that we were brought over here as slaves. We were brought over here to work and die. And I heard one brother say that we need to start from the ground up. Well, I have to tell you something, brother. I agree with that theory. That's a good position. But guess what? We have enough black public officials around the country, mayors, congresspeople, state reps, chiefs, commissioners. And I'm going to tell you something, brother, for someone who works in government, that all those different levels of government, local, state, and federal, all have appropriation committees. And I learned something about this disease, that they released $1 trillion. $1 trillion could have gave us reparations. $1 trillion could have fixed Flint, Michigan. And I'm going to tell you something else, brother. It could fix all the problems that we have around the country. The people who are in government, specifically, are holding that money and doing what they want to do with that money. Some of us should be at the ground, but some of us are at the top. And I'm going to tell you this, that when we hold back on doing what we're supposed to do in these places, history repeats itself. If we're there not doing anything, that's just as worse as the enemy. Are you working with the enemy or are you the enemy?
Right.
We got to come. Let me tell you something. The first thing they should do, once the Democrats, who I will believe should be elected and will be elected, is they should first come up with universal health care. We see that now. We don't even have benefits to be taken care of.
Right.
In Philadelphia, every time you turn around, they're removing things from a lot, and they're using the church or recreation center to do testing. They don't even have the equipment. Mm-hmm. And the president had jets flown from the Navy and the Air Force. Nurses come out of the hospital and wave. I said, don't y'all need equipment? You waving for this junk? He's spending all that money for that? And we'll tell you to take bleach, Clorox bleach,
right,
and Lysol,
yeah,
injectors. Come on, man. Let's get out of this. Remember this, man. You're not accepted in this system.
Yeah.
I'm a nationalist, but we got to make up our mind in what direction we're going to go. It's handicapped as a people.
Right.
Now, we're going to get out of this, or we're going to stay here. And I believe that a vote is coming up, and we have a chance to elect some folks. And I hope, take them to the task, that we got to come out of this situation better. Because even when the New Deal came about, we wasn't a part of that New Deal. Are we going to be a part of this one?
Right.
All right.
Okay, Brother Timothy, I appreciate it, as always. Thank you so much. Let me go over here to my brother from, and I do really appreciate he listens to our program every week, but he is in the war zone. He's at the zero level of the war zone, a brother from New York City. I really appreciate him coming on. He's probably still in a state of mourning. I know he lost his wife to this COVID thing. But anyway, I just wanted to kind of just always say hello to him and see how he's doing and check on him. Good afternoon, my brother. How you doing? 917-662. Okay, I guess he's just listening. But I appreciate you. In case you do hear me, I appreciate you do listening, and my prayers are still with you, you know, during your loss. There's also another horrible story coming out of New York City that I was just reading about in Sunday's paper. They're using, well, they've been doing it, but they're using those prisoners out of Rikers Island to bury all of those thousands of homeless people in that what's called Potter's Field, but it's a Hartsfield Cemetery down in Lower Manhattan, by the East River. They're being buried there, and I understand that some of them are not being buried. They're being dumped into the water. And so some of those horror stories that are happening, but that is the case. And I said they use the inmates to handle those burials. They always have. But that's a horrible story, and then maybe at some point in time we can find somebody that could give us some insight into that. I don't know whether Brother Griffin from Newport News, are you interested in saying anything, or are you just listening, Brother Griffin? Brother Griffin, Newport News, just listening. Okay.
Bob, can I just interject for 1 second?
Sure.
When the brother was just talking about politicians.
I'm sorry, say that again. Say it just a little bit louder.
The conversation about with all these elected officials that we have participating in this European political system.
Okay.
We have to start being realistic with what they can and can't do. We've been here before. During the first Reconstruction, brothers and sisters were getting elected into political office in the 1800s. So this is not new to us. We have to deal with the reality. Them brothers and sisters that get those positions, they just in position. They have a title and they have a job. They can't influence what's going to happen with this European system.
Okay.
We played this game, family. At some point, we're going to have to grow up. The game, the political game is not going to work for us. It just ain't working. So we're going to have to create our own independent social, political, and economics. And we already have it. It's in place, but we just not using it for our – and it's got to get to the point where we start practicing black nationalism. And all black nationalism means is that we're going to put ourselves first.
Okay.
We're going to put ourselves – that's all black nationalism is.
All right.
But we – confused about going back to Africa, putting on kente cloth. That ain't what black nationalism is about.
Okay.
It's about self-preservation, preservation of our culture.
I hate to cut you off. We got about 7 minutes. Let me ask Brother Pugh, you have a response to that?
Did you ask me that? Do I have a response?
Yeah. Do you have a response? He was responding to your question.
Well, I didn't necessarily think he was speaking to me, but I guess he was saying that politics is passe and so on. Well, it turns out that war is actually political, and so the notion, and in fact, war is also strategic, where you want to take advantage of every option that you have, and so. The ideal of taking one of your strategic tools and throwing them away for some ideological purpose, that's the equivalent of nonviolence. Everyone recognizes that nonviolence is an ideological position, but it's not strategically wise. Sometimes it's appropriate to be nonviolent, sometimes it's not. Similarly, sometimes it's appropriate to be political, sometimes it's not. And so taking the ideological position that you're going to avoid politics, I think, is unwise.
Okay. All right.
I didn't mean,
I only got a few minutes, though, Brother Alfonso, and I want to give each one of y'all a chance to close it out. Uh-huh. Go ahead. I'm sorry. You can go ahead. Finish your sentence.
No, I didn't mean throw it away. I mean, we have to create our own political machine.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying. Politics is warfare.
All
but
right.
I'm saying we can't continue to participate in the context of how Europeans participate in it.
Okay. All right. One last person. I got a caller at Federal North Carolina, 910-237. Any comments listening, or you just listening?
Just one comment, brother, about the brother talking about the health condition. I think we can go back to Elijah Muhammad, how to eat to live would be a good piece of literature to promote to keep us in proper direction. Y'all have a good evening.
Great, great. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Well, okay, Brother Terrence, you want to give us a closing statement on your behalf? And then I'm going to go to Brother Marshall and then Brother Alfonso, and then we should be through.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for the opportunity, Doc.
Yes, thank you.
For me, it's always a pleasure and opportunity to be in the company of great minds like Brother Alfonso and Brother Marshall. You know, I was just sitting and listening and just continuing to learn. And I think it's just, at least for me personally, part of my continuing struggle to, you know, help advance my people. And I want to thank you again for the opportunity to be a part of it.
And thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate that. Thank you. And I'm going to have you back again and talk about some other stuff. Okay? Brother Marshall?
Well, I want to thank you for the opportunity. And my closing words would be, I think we should always remain mindful that the coronavirus does not discriminate, but it's our house economic and healthcare policies that do. And environmental racism, unaffordable housing, lack of job opportunities, and many other social determinants of health will determine, you know, how many Black people will remain at risk. To flatten the curve of COVID-19 and to prevent future pandemics from wreaking havoc in our communities, these conditions must be addressed.
And thank you so much, Brother Marshall. I appreciate you coming on and agreeing to be a part of this discussion. Thank you very much. And I will be calling on you
thank
again.
You.
Brother Alfonso.
Give me a call anytime.
Okay. All right. Brother Alfonso, you want to take us
home?
Yes,
Father. Once again, it's always a pleasure to be in your company and in the company of the family. I would just like to say Neely Fuller's book, the compensatory piece where he does the 9 areas of human activity. We have to create think tanks around those areas of activity for us to be independent and free thinking people. So I know many people have read or are aware of Neely Fuller's book, but those are the areas that I think as we think about nationhood, building independence, those areas, I think we must master those areas and create our own independent systems around that. Peace and blessings, family.
Beautiful. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. Don't forget, we'll be back on Saturday at 3 o'clock Central Time. It is our weekend edition. We're going to be talking about the economics of the Black community and its the impact from COVID on the economics. And we will get into some issues and some data and some research that our two hosts, LaWanda Chambers and Leola Williams, has brought together with some guests that are going to talk about the money. Money, money, money. And we want to get to the heart of that. So, again, thank you for joining us tonight. We had a wonderful conversation with my three brothers. And, again, I said we will be back here on Saturday at 3 o'clock Central Time. Thank you and have a great day.
virgin land.
Let my people go.
He made old Pharaoh understand.
Let my people go.
Yes, the Lord said, go down.
Go down.
Moses.
Moses.
To let my people go.
Let my people go.
Thus spoke the Lord, bold Moses said,
let my people go.
If not, I'll smite your firstborn dead.
Let my people go.
The Lord said, go down.
Go down.
Moses.
Moses.